Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So, Robert.
Yes.
I want to put you in a strange scenario.
Okay.
I want you to imagine yourself an astronaut in a near future dystopia. In fact, a truly dystopian scenario from my perspective.
Easy to do. This is an exercise I try to employ, you know, every day.
Okay. Now, you might be going to a kind of Orwellian place, like the totalitarian hell. Don't go there.
Okay.
Or you might be going to like the Aldous Huxley place where we're all just medicated and placated and have an empty, soulless bliss.
Ooh, that's good too.
Not there.
Oh, okay.
I want you to put yourself in the actuarial capitalist bureaucracy of the private insurance market.
Okay. So we land in a place that's maybe a little more comfortable but a little more mundane.
Yeah.
Okay.
So specifically what you're trying to do is purchase a suite of insurance policies that'll protect you and your family if you suffer death, disability, or a serious medical condition in your line of work.
Okay.
So during a brief interview, there's a policy agent who has to ask you a few questions to determine whether they can sell you a policy and what your rate's going to be. So you get the standard ones. Are you a smoker?
No.
Heavy drinker?
No.
IV drug user?
Wait. What? This is the future, right?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Duelist and or gunslinger.
This is the future?
Yeah.
I'll say sometimes.
How about drag race junkie?
No.
Knight of the sacred art of the motor joust?
No.
Do you work with high voltage, nitroglycerin, or flying guillotines?
Not currently.
And does your church congregation practice snake handling?
Not bio snake. So we're good.
Right. You only get those safe synthetic snakes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so we get, you know, the spirit of the practice is still true.
It's not the Middle Ages. Yeah. Come on.
Exactly. It's the future.
Okay, so we're all the way through the interview except for one final question. Are you now or have you ever been on the waiting list for a space colonization project?
And there you got me.
Yeah, I got you. Sorry, that's the kicker because, Robert, I know that you are, in fact, currently in astronaut training to become one of the members of the first wave of semi-permanent Mars colonists. And depending on circumstances, you might be spending the next 6 to 12 years and maybe the rest of your natural life in a habitat on the surface of a red, red wasteland. And unfortunately, you're well aware of this and well aware of the fact that if you answer yes to this question, your monthly payments are going to be so high as to defeat the entire purpose of the insurance policy.
Right, because this is a risky venture. This is even beyond drag racing and motor jousting and what have you. This is a risky lifestyle to take on.
How true that is. Now, you could do what Neil Armstrong and the rest of the crew of Apollo 11 did. Did you ever hear about this story?
No, the whole insurance policies for astronauts is an area I've not explored.
Well, when the crew of the Apollo 11 mission, who were going to be the first people to land on the moon, realized that life insurance policies would be prohibitively expensive for them, they came up with an interesting idea to make a policy of their own. So during the month when they were in quarantine before launch, and this is true, they signed hundreds of autographed covers, they were called, which were these envelopes postmarked with historically significant dates on them. And they were autographing these covers, and then they would deliver them all to their families. This way they knew that if they didn't survive the mission, the sale of autographed memorabilia would at least be enough to keep their families afloat.
Ah, so since I'm probably not going to get this insurance policy because of my my aspirations to become a Mars colonist, I can at least set up the possibility that my family can make money off the fact that I am/was the first man to die on Mars.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I could see that. Yeah. I mean, the motion pictures that would be made about me.
Yeah. The rights to your life. Who's going to play you dying on Mars?
I hope everybody. They would do like a Bob Dylan kind of thing where different actors and actresses would play me at different stages of my demise.
Right. Cate Blanchett is you gasping on the Red Rocks.
I think that's perfect.
That would be pretty cool. But anyway, put yourself back in the scenario. So the insurance agent, that question might actually cause you to have some second thoughts about your plans to go to Mars because of what your body is going to be up against. Now, you know a few things, but you might not realize the entire spate of potential challenges to your health and well-being while living on Mars, well, while bound for Mars and once you get there, especially since you couldn't wait out the years of preparation it was going to take to be part of the joint NASA-JAXA-ESA mission, and instead you have signed up with a kind of sketchy-sounding nonprofit-based Mars colonization outfit because they promised liftoff within 18 months, and you're in a hurry. Though from what you've seen so far, they might be cutting some corners.
Yeah, I was very skeptical of the wooden spaceship approach that they were looking to employ.
Did you ever read that? What was it? There was a proposition that that the movie Alien 3 was originally going to about a wooden planet.
Oh yeah, wooden space station manned by monks.
I always loved that idea. I wish they'd made that. Anyway, back to the story. So this is a good jumping off point to talk about the real thrust of today's episode, which is the question: what are all of the health challenges that our bodies might face over the course of a long-term Mars colonization effort, both traveling to Mars and living there for years at a time or maybe for a whole lifetime? And are there any ways we know of to overcome these challenges?
Yeah, it's a big question, one that NASA and other space exploration authorities continue to look into, because that's kind of the next big phase, right? That's the dream. That's our generation's moon, the idea of actually making it to the red planet, of leaving this world that we've evolved to thrive on and to thrive within a very slim portion of the atmosphere and also only in certain regions of the planet, to leave this world, travel through the unforgiving void of space to a rather lifeless world and somehow make a go of it.
Yeah, well, we certainly don't want to discourage Mars exploration with this podcast, but I think it's just helpful, while encouraging the exploratory and scientific spirit, to also realize what a truly horrible place Mars is. So I think we should start with some of the more obvious and more often talked about issues, such as radiation and reduced gravity, microgravity, or zero gravity, as the case may be, and then move on to some of the more obscure concerns. So the biggest health concern, quite obviously, for Mars travelers is going to be radiation exposure.
Indeed. We live in a kind of privileged situation here on Earth because we're largely shielded from some of the harsher radiation that can reach us in the form of cosmic radiation and a lot of the solar radiation.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And we actually would have to deal with radiation in two different scenarios that both apply to the Mars colonist. So there's going to be the radiation on the way to Mars. Mm-hmm. And the radiation once you get there, because it's a sad fact that Mars is not shielded the way Earth is. So both cosmic and solar radiation immediately become a problem once you leave the neighborhood of Earth. Even on Earth's surface, we're actually exposed to a steady ambient level of radiation from the sun and from the larger universe. That would be solar radiation and cosmic radiation, respectively. But Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere, so that's the magnetic field generated by the dynamo effect when the Earth's liquid metal outer core rotates around the inner core.
Mm-hmm. An effect that most planets that we know of do not feature.
Yeah. That protects us from the danger. So most of the incoming radiation gets deflected or absorbed, and we don't really have to worry about it. Even astronauts on the International Space Station, which is on average 249 miles above the surface of Earth, even though they're exposed to more radiation than we get on the surface, they're still shielded by Earth's magnetosphere, which extends thousands of miles out into space.
Yeah, when you take that into account, I mean, as hostile and unforgiving as the orbital environment is, mm-hmm. it makes it seem like like a 5-year-old camping in his parents' backyard compared to actually venturing beyond the magnetosphere into this unprotected region of space.
Well, it's the equivalent of like wading into 3 feet of water as opposed to swimming across the ocean.
Yeah.
So once you're traveling in outer space on the way to Mars, you no longer have these protective barriers. And even once you get to Mars, as we said, things aren't going to be much better because Mars does not have a strong magnetosphere like Earth, and its atmosphere is absolutely puny. It's mm-hmm. puny and thin. It's about 1% the thickness of Earth's atmosphere. So you're just not going to get much protection from radiation on Mars. And there are ways to get around this. So people have been coming up with all kinds of habitat and spaceship designs that would try to shield astronauts from the various types of radiation they would encounter. So some ideas are how to make shielding around a spaceship that would absorb cosmic rays and try to prevent secondary radiation from shooting off and irradiating you. One interesting idea I've read about is surrounding the crew capsule with organic materials and water. So all of the food and human waste and water and things like that would sort of form a weird moist bioshield around you.
Oh, wow. So in a sense, you would be sailing to Mars in a protective bubble of your own sewage.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, like it's sewage to the future. It'll save your life. Hopefully. But we need to do more research to determine exactly what the risks are and if we can create a system like this that's economically feasible and will keep astronauts safe. Because another problem is, sure, you can build a radiation shield. I mean, we build stuff like that all the time. We have nuclear power plants, people who work mm-hmm. with radiation, and they can do that with relative protection. But it's expensive to ship stuff into space. And the more bulk you're adding to your ship to shield yourself, the more trouble you're making this mission.
Yeah, and is in a continuing theme that we'll keep coming back to here is so much of this work is still ongoing. We're still trying to find the answers, mm-hmm. Still trying to figure out the best methods and dealing with a limited ability to experiment on them in real life.
Totally true. And unfortunately, it's not even just the standard radiation risks that we're going to be dealing with during the trip to Mars. So a standard trip to Mars might take somewhere around 6 months. Mm-hmm. This is an estimate you see thrown out a lot. And during those 6 months, and once you get to Mars, it's not just the increased risk of cancer and other standard dangers associated with radiation. Astronauts bound for Mars might face even weirder and more disturbing dangers. For example, brain damage. So there is some evidence that the kinds of cosmic rays that'll be cutting through your body on a regular basis while you're on the way to Mars can produce brain damage leading to symptoms somewhat analogous to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And I've read a few articles about this. So medical doctors have noted that some patients who receive radiation to the head in the course of treating brain cancer display side effects like increased confusion and other cognitive impairments, and cosmic rays might do pretty much the same thing to us. So in recent experiments, researchers have subjected mice to simulated cosmic rays, and 6 weeks after acute exposure to this radiation, the mice exhibited decreased cognitive performance as well as physiological changes to brain tissue. And I just want to read this quote from the abstract of the study. It was, "Reductions in dendritic complexity and spine density along the medial prefrontal cortical neurons known to mediate neurotransmission specifically interrogated by our behavioral tasks." So your ability to behave with intelligence could be impaired by the time you arrive at Mars. Showing up at Mars brain damaged is not a good idea.
Right when a lot of the really heavy work is about to begin.
Yeah, and so a couple of notes. These are mice brains, not human brains, and we know there's some difference there. Also, we should be able to protect against this, like I was saying earlier, if we prepare and invest enough, if we do the research, figure out what the vulnerabilities are, and build the right kind of shielding. But again, it's an economics problem. Can we invest enough resources to make sure people are safe from these effects? If you're going on the nonprofit, cutting corners, get you there fast mission, that might not be the case.
Yeah, I don't know if the balsa wood shielding is going to work in the outfit that I've been reading the brochure about.
Yeah, but of course it's not just the radiation that will threaten our bodies on the trip to Mars. What about the effects of microgravity?
Yeah, this is a big one, and again, I'm sure this is one that that everyone's familiar with on some level. You know, it often shows. Well, I was about to say it often shows up in science fiction, but more often it's ignored in science fiction. The whole issue of gravity and the lack of gravity in space flight. Generally, you just throw in some sort of magical artificial gravity scenario, and you don't worry about it.
I always respect the science fiction universes that have some kind of rotating device on the ship to generate the force of gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's not just the Millennium Falcon, you can walk around wherever.
Yeah, because the bottom line, of course, is that we evolved on a world with a certain amount of gravitational pull.
And we're completely adapted to it.
Yeah, everything about our form. I mean, gravity dictates the form of our muscle groups, and gravity alone forces a certain level of exercise on you at all times. So even if you're just, you know, standing in your apartment, otherwise doing nothing, your body's still working with gravity. And on a microscopic level, our skeleton constantly alters its structure to bear the gravitational forces of our planet. Even our organs work with Earth gravity. I mean, our heart beats against gravity when it pushes blood up to our brain. So, I mean, we are just steeped in it. We often take it for granted. I mean, we almost always take it for granted. But we are creatures that have evolved to live with our gravity, with Earth gravity.
Yeah, you don't think about it, but your body is constantly having to compensate for gravity. I mean, the gravity wants to pull you toward the floor. The gravity wants to pull all your blood into your feet. So like you said, your circulatory system, like you mentioned, has to pump more blood pressure into the top of your body just to make sure you get an even circulation, all because of gravity.
Indeed. So when we send astronauts into space, when they go into orbit, they experience a certain amount of muscle and skeletal system deterioration.
It's called getting soft.
Yeah, yeah, and literally that's what happens. The muscles, especially the underutilized leg muscles, become flabby, lose tone and mass. Muscular atrophy occurs. Bone becomes weaker because of the loss of the minerals, calcium, potassium, and sodium. And the bone degeneration can reduce bone in the lower limbs by up to 10%. So it's essentially a form of osteoporosis known as spaceflight osteopenia.
Yeah, and astronauts have to do tons of exercise just to prevent this from being worse than it is.
Yeah, there's a lot of exercise. Also, astronauts will generally take various vitamins and even some pharmaceuticals. Particularly, they'll take calcium and vitamin D. NASA often tends to have their astronauts take clay to supposedly help with calcium retention. And then also, and it's thought that osteoporosis drugs can be helpful in mitigating this as well. it's interesting. The calcium is especially a problem. The calcium loss in the bones. 99% of our body's calcium is stored in the skeleton, and when we lose it in low gravity, it enters the bloodstream, where an excess of calcium can cause a host of unpleasantries. You know, it can be as mild as just, you know, diarrhea, but you don't need another reason to have diarrhea in space.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't need a reason to have any condition in space. That plays on another problem that's not a medical condition in itself, but just the fact that if you're headed toward Mars or on Mars, you are so far away from the nearest medical facility.
Yeah, you've got to have it all in the back, ready to go. I mean,
yeah, what if you get a kidney stone on Mars?
Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing about the exercise, because it's easy to imagine, all right, we'd have our drug hamper just completely filled up, and our vitamins and our osteoporosis medications. But then, and we'll just be hitting the treadmill the whole time. But, you know, we've been working with this problem for decades, and experts still aren't really convinced, you know, what the best method of exercise is, and if exercise really helps to mitigate this. Cause you're talking about constant ambient gravitational pressure on the body. Mm-hmm. And that's not something you can really replicate with our current systems of, you know, treadmills or even some of these, like these force, suits that the Russians experimented with in the past, where there would be like this, where just the act of moving your arm would have a certain amount of exercise.
Right. The resistance suits.
Yeah.
I read about those. Those are interesting.
Yeah. There's a space musical by the name of, The American Astronaut, and there's a character that shows up. Named Bodysuit, and he's this. he's been living in deep space for a long time, and has one of these resistance suits on to keep his body strong.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, his father is just this stringy creature that's completely lost all of his bone mass and has this enormous swollen head. It's a common exploration in sci-fi. I guess some of the headier sci-fi, like Dan Simon's Hyperion books. There's like a race of humans that live in weightless environments, and they're very, very tall and elongated.
Creepy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you've ever seen live footage of astronauts on the International Space Station, you might have noticed that they look a little weird. Like, what exactly is wrong with their bodies? That's an effect of weightlessness, where body fluids are redistributed up from the legs and into the chest, shoulders, and head. So if their face looks puffy and they've got the kind of bodybuilder shoulders, that's because of the microgravity environment.
Yeah, there's so many things we don't even necessarily think about. One that always amazes me is how your bladder fills up in a weightless environment.
Oh, I've never heard about this.
Yeah, because we've evolved to live in gravity. So as our bladder fills up, that water is subject to gravity. And as it starts getting a little bit towards the tipping point, we realize, hey, I need to go to the bathroom. I should go and relieve this.
Uh-huh.
But if you're in a weightless environment,
oh, no.
It's not filling from the bottom up. It's just kind of filling all around. So astronauts don't often realize they have to go urinate until they've reached like maximum capacity, like almost, you know, dangerous levels of full bladder.
Oh man.
Yeah.
So it's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, so it kind of transforms an adventurous adult into a toddler who suddenly realizes, I've got to go to the bathroom and there's nothing I can do to stop it.
All right, but that's all just in space flight when you're in this effectively zero G environment, the microgravity environment, floating around. When you're on the International Space Station for a number of months, you can eventually come back to Earth and retrain. Your body might never be exactly the same as it was before you went up to the ISS, but you can regain a lot of lost capacity. One question I have is, to what extent is that going to be true once astronauts get out of the ship after 6 months in weightlessness and then walk around on Mars? Because Mars is not Earth.
Right. 62% less gravity there. So, You would certainly leave behind this weightless environment of space travel, but you're certainly not going back to Earth levels of gravity. You're going back to something far lighter.
Yeah. And so what is the effect of living in 62% less gravity for years at a time or the rest of your life? I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question yet.
Yeah, it's just not something we've dealt with thus far. And this is, again, an area where our our research into ways to mitigate spaceflight osteopenia has to improve. We have to figure out better ways to tackle it with improved exercise system, improved pharmaceuticals and vitamin regimens. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, and then there are a whole host of other effects we observe in astronauts in weightless environments that are not even related to the decay of muscle and bone density. One example would be vision. Have you ever read about astronaut vision impairment?
No.
Yeah, this is a thing. So on Earth, like we were saying, our circulatory system has adapted to give us even blood circulation despite the effects of gravity yanking our blood toward the ground. So without the gravity, your body overcompensates for gravity that isn't there and puts way too much blood into your head.
Oh, wow. So you can essentially red out without the aid of a jet fighter.
It's actually the continuous effects of this increased blood pressure in the head that cause the biggest problem. One common symptom is farsightedness. Another thing is this thing called cotton wool spots in your field of vision, and that's caused by damage to the nerve fibers in the back of the eye. So now we've got a few things. When you get out of the ship, so you've just arrived at Mars, you might have decreased bone and muscle density.
Yes.
Possibly brain damage if you didn't take, you know, your proper radiation shielding, and impaired vision. That's not a way to build a colony.
Right.
So I don't know if the impaired vision effects would carry over onto Mars either, or to what extent the Mars gravity would help solve the problem. Again, we don't know about the long-term effects of living on reduced gravity.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will consider the Martian dust. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elia Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. As we've been discussing, we've arrived at Mars, and we've just been ravaged by microgravity, radiation, and now we're actually on the surface. And here comes the Martian dust.
Right. So we've dealt with the main threats to health and well-being that people bring up, the microgravity and the radiation. But it turns out there are a bunch of other ones. And the Martian dust is a particularly interesting one to me. In December of 1972, the astronauts Harrison Schmitt and Eugene Cernan of Apollo 17 landed on the moon, and they were carrying out some surface missions. And once upon returning from the Taurus-Littrow Valley, which is close to the Sea of Serenity on the moon, The two astronauts re-entered the lunar module, and Harrison Schmitt reported respiratory distress from inhaling particles of moon dust that they had tracked into the capsule with them. And to make it sound cute, he called it lunar dust hay fever. That does sound cute, but the actual situation isn't so cute. And while working on the surface of the moon, the Apollo astronauts have noticed a consistently annoying and troubling thing about the moon. It's covered in this sticky, abrasive dust that, true fact, smells like gunpowder, they all report, and it gets all over everything. Astronauts found that it's these sharp-edged, abrasive dust grains, almost like a tiny shards of glass, and they would embed themselves in surfaces, and it was just impossible to prevent astronauts from bringing it with them when they returned from outside. And this has proven a tough problem for anybody imagining a return trip to the moon or a moon colony, because if the trip involves any extravehicular activity, moon colonists are going to have this dust problem.
Yeah, I've read about some of this before. It's interesting. You just see those images of the moon, and you kind of default to imagining it as being covered with, you know, just sand, or maybe like a fine flour consistency. But it's rough stuff, and it gets over everything. Another aspect is that it's dark. It's like and it's dark gray kind of material, and you're on the moon, and it coats your instruments, it coats your equipment, maybe it coats your spacesuit, and it's going to cause whatever it's coating to start heat up in the sun, because it's the dust itself will absorb the solar radiation. So suddenly it's like you're wearing a black coat on a sunny day, and you're just getting hotter and hotter because of the dust on you.
Yeah, and you don't want to sweat like a pig on the moon.
No. Yeah, so you could, you know, essentially wind up cooked via lunar dust.
Scary thought, but that's the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Mars might have a similar problem, but basically even more horrible. So one problem is fine grains of silicate materials. So here on Earth, human miners often suffer from a disease called silicosis. If you're working in like a mine or a quarry, or if you work in tunneling, drilling, sandblasting, glassworks, any of these things, your work environment can produce extremely fine-grained particles of silicon dioxide or silica dust in the air. And silica is a totally common mineral. It's not one of those things to get upset about as a material itself. Sand is mostly silica. Right. If ingested in reasonable quantities orally, it's non-toxic. But if you breathe in extremely fine particles of silica dust, they can become embedded in your lungs and your body can't remove them. So depending on the level and length of exposure, this can lead to irritation, swelling, and difficulty breathing, and eventually to progressive massive fibrosis, which means your lungs are pretty much destroyed. And long-term exposure to crystalline silica is also considered a cancer risk. This is a bad recipe for lung health. Martian soil contains fine-grained silicate particles that are largely different from the particles of quartz silica that we'd risk breathing on Earth, though they might produce similar or even worse effects. So years ago, researchers at Stony Brook University in New York pulverized samples of the most common basaltic minerals you'd find in the Martian soil, feldspar, pyroxene, and olivine, to see what would happen when this faux Martian dust reacted with moisture the way it would with the moisture in your lungs if you breathe it in. And the results were kind of gross. A mixture of 5 milliliters of water with a couple hundred milligrams of the synthetic Mars dust reacted to create hydrogen peroxide, so fizzy, fizzy party times, hydroxyl, and a negatively charged oxygen ion called superoxide. Not really things you want in your lungs. In addition to this, scientists believe Martian soil contains perchlorates, which have detrimental effects on the thyroid and hormone production in the human body. So not only is it likely to cause irritation and lung diseases if inhaled chronically over time, it can also poison you. And it gets worse. On Mars, there are dust storms of titanic proportions. You don't really have to worry about dust storms on the moon. On Mars, you do. The dust storms there can become so bad they can become planet-wide dust storms engulfing the entire surface. So welcome to Planet Poison Storm. don't breathe in. As far as I'm aware, there is no known solution to this problem yet, except maybe just never going outside. I guess if you seal yourself off in an airtight container and, you know, you're never going in or out, then you could probably be okay.
But then what are you doing, right, as a colonist?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I've read in the past, I think in the context of moon exploration, about NASA researchers looking into designs for things like handheld vacuums and airlocks. And I don't know where that research is today, but it seems like even that would have trouble completely solving the dust problem.
Yeah, because are you just going to bring an entire ship of vacuums that steadily break down from all the particles that are surging through the system?
Yeah, and then there's the question of how the dust would actually affect the equipment in your habitat. So is the dust going to be clogging air filters? Is it going to be getting into instruments that you need to perform your scientific work? And so by and large, the dust is going to be a huge problem. And it's something we really need to think about if we're actually going to be sending people to Mars.
And that's assuming that the dust doesn't suddenly turn into a giant hand, like the Stephen King short story Beach World, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because then it's a whole set of problems in addition to just breathing it in.
Or wait a minute, what does the dust do in Mission to Mars?
Ooh, you know, I don't think I ever saw Mission to Mars.
Oh, well, you're one of the lucky ones.
All right. Well, the next thing to think about, you know, on the surface seems a little less intensive. You know, it's not as crazy as dust that's gradually killing you, or the loss of bone mass, or even the harmful effects of radiation. But it is very real, and you can think of it as just an additional thing you would have to deal with on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how life on Mars would affect your circadian rhythm. I have to admit, I never really thought about this myself, but a Mars day, called a sol, is 39 minutes and 35 seconds longer than an Earth day.
Ooh, that's just close enough that it seems maybe even worse than if it were way different.
Well, you know, Yeah, and on the surface, it doesn't, maybe doesn't sound like much. You might even think, oh, it's a good thing. I can watch one extra episode of my favorite hour-long show, sans commercials, right? It's 40 minutes. I can get it in, right? Maybe 40 minutes of extra sleep. But, we actually have some experience dealing with the problems of, an extra 40 odd minutes in the day. As every time NASA lands a rover on Mars, operations teams have to adapt to the Martian schedule.
Huh.
There's a great article that deals with this that appeared in Scientific American by it's an article by Katie Wirth titled "Step into the Twilight Zone: Can Earthlings Adjust to a Longer Day on Mars?" And she describes how those extra 40 minutes, you know, they weren't bad at first, but you have this crew and they're dealing with the Martian day, they're dealing with the Earth day, and they're dealing with both across multiple time zones. So the 40 minutes just begins to add up over time. It just ends up causing high levels of exhaustion. So they end up trying limiting shifts to 4 days in a row, no more. But even this causes the Martian minutes to catch up with you after time.
Yeah, because you have to imagine it. It's not just that you would get an extra long day one day and then you get to sleep and reset. Every day, this accumulation of the extra 40 minutes is adding on to the accumulation of the day before.
Mm-hmm. Now,
it's like continuous jet lag.
Yeah. Now, we're in for some good news because one of the things is once you actually get to Mars, you're at least going to have, cycles of day and night to tie in with your circadian rhythm. So it's thought that you would probably adjust pretty well to this extra 40 minutes once you're on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, one of the problems is that you've been traveling through space completely cut off from cycles of night and day unless there's some sort of artificial stimulation of your circadian rhythm. and you're still going to have to, on some level, deal with time back home. And this is where you get into questions about, all right, what's going to be the degree of communication with the home world? I'm guessing, especially in an early, low-budget visit to Mars, it's going to be pretty minimal. You're not going to have any direct Skype conversations with your family back home.
No, you're just going to be broadcasting your reality television show.
Yeah. Yeah, and it, with some tape delay, right?
Yeah.
But the people back home, the people looking after you and seeing how operations are going, they're going to be the ones suffering from that extra 40 minutes as they have to simultaneously live in two different time zones at once.
Hmm.
And this plays into another area that I've thought about before too. Like, how do we end up keeping track of time in general when we start looking towards an interplanetary future? Where you have different lengths of days on different worlds, and then you have to deal with the distance between those worlds, the time delay and communication.
In some cases, you might even have to deal with noticeable time dilation.
Exactly, yeah.
If you're talking about like near light speed travel between different, the idea of time starts to lose its sense of universality when you're talking about an interplanetary species.
Yeah, it's a great example of taking a very terrestrial concept and then trying to make sense of it when we leave the planet. We've touched on religion in that sense, and you know now we're talking about time and the human body. I can't even imagine how many different additions to that there are that we're not even thinking about. All the little things that add up to make interplanetary life all the stranger.
Totally. I was trying to think about it in the car on the way to work this morning. Like, how do you synchronize Mars time with Earth time? There's only 40 minutes difference each day, but what do you do? Does Mars just have 39 point something extra minutes that go up on the clock and then it resets to zero? Or I'm sure nobody would actually try to do this, but for a minute my brain went to the place of, would you just make your minutes a little bit longer and have 24-hour days? Or
yeah, it gets very complicated. And again, we have some experience with this in the way that NASA workers looking after any kind of operations on Mars have to add that 40 extra minutes into their day.
Well, I've got another way that we are completely and totally adapted to Earth, and I think we haven't fully considered the ramifications of removing our culture to a non-Earth location, and that is microbiota.
Ah, and this is one I had never thought of either. But even though on the show, we've done a number of episodes dealing with microbiota and how essentially we're just this population of different bacteria and different microbiotic organisms that all kind of work together as one spaceship.
Oh, totally. So, yeah, imagine you're a colonist on Mars. Where are you going to get your food? Well, I imagine you're going to be growing it, right?
Yeah, or you know, getting it from the cube dispenser. Right?
Yeah, I mean, so if you're an astronaut in the ISS, you can live on vacuum-packed shrimp cocktail for a couple months, and that's not going to kill you. On Mars, you can't take all your food with you
right.
when you go. You're going to have to somehow grow crops for yourself once you're at your semi-permanent colony on Mars. So maybe you could survive on hydroponics, like rooting plants in nutrient-filled water, or maybe even aeroponics, like free-growing roots in the air fed by a nutrient-rich mist or spray. Makes sense. But there's a crucial question there we might not be taking into consideration. What happens when you drive a 140-million-mile wedge between Earthlings and Earth's soil?
Ah.
Because Mars is a microbiotic desert, and this is a digression, but I had to report that Microsoft Word wanted to change microbiotic desert to macrobiotic dessert.
That's how appalled Microsoft is at the idea of life on Mars.
Right. So I read a really interesting article about this in Slate from 2013 called Our Guts May Hate Mars. And the author, Michael Chorost, makes the interesting point that the soil we live on isn't just an inert mass of stuff for plants to sit in. It's an ecosystem. It's an ecosystem of its own, like a rainforest or a coral reef, and it is teeming with life, including bacteria, insects, worms, protozoa, and this ecosystem is something that humans have never really tried to live without for years at a time. So, a few considerations. One of them is the bacteria found in Earth soil is probably important for maintaining your microbiotic profile, because as we were alluding to a minute ago, your body isn't just your body. You are a symbiont.
Mm-hmm.
You have legions of benign microorganisms that live inside you, for example, in your digestive system. And without healthy gut flora, humans can suffer serious consequences. Like, what happens to you if you don't have healthy gut flora?
A lot of bad things can happen. I mean, yeah. At the very least, diarrhea in space.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a bad thing to happen in space.
Yeah. And, you know, this reminds me, too, of some past episodes we've done on the show dealing with the problems of creating all these artificial environments that we live in now. Just talking about our, you know, our office spaces
yeah.
where you have an entirely different microbiotic profile that emerges because it is separated from the soil, separated from the natural microbiotic environment in which we live. And that's just here on Earth
yeah.
at your workplace.
Yeah. And so in this article, Chorost points out that scientists say organisms that live in the Earth soil also provide countless, quote, ecosystem services that go unnoticed, but which are really important for keeping the rest of life on Earth running smoothly. And these services include things like the breakdown of dead organic matter, water filtration, carbon dioxide cycling. And he cites Justin L. Sonnenberg, a microbiologist and immunologist from the Stanford School of Medicine, who also says a couple of really interesting things. One of them is that the soil bacteria on Earth might make your food better.
Hmm.
So when you grow crops in the teeming micro jungle of Earth's soil, the plants have to face off against enemies. They have to face off against predators, parasites of the ecosystem. And this causes the plants to, you know, be like Rocky when in the training montage. It makes the plants strong. And in getting strong, they have to synthesize compounds like antioxidants that make the plants more nutritious for us when we eat them. And so without having to fight off the microbiotic onslaught, the plants we eat wouldn't do all the same beneficial things for our bodies that they do here on Earth.
Hmm.
And this is just one example of the many ways the complexities of Earth's soil contribute to our well-being. The point is, we don't know all of the ways that Earth's soil contributes to our well-being and to what extent we might be able to survive without it, and we might face health and well-being problems that are much bigger than we could have expected.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
So we get to Mars and we're flabby and fightless. Due to our bone and muscle loss, and then we're growing some sort of hydroponic pumpkin to eat that's equally flabby and fightless because it doesn't have to deal with the natural predators and microbiota that it has evolved to combat.
Yeah, how many ways Mars would make us soft?
Yeah.
Well, so there's one potential solution, right? What if we just shipped a bunch of soil with us to Mars? So you just pack up dirt from Earth. And you take it, mm-hmm. and you protect it along the way because you don't want irradiated soil either. And then you grow your crops in that. Would that work? Probably not. And there are a couple of reasons. One of the things is that we've alluded to already is cost. It's unbelievably expensive to put mass into orbit.
even more expensive to send it all the way out of Earth's gravity well as we would need to do to get it to Mars. The old figure that was commonly cited was that it cost $10,000 per pound to put stuff into low Earth orbit.
Right.
With all the private space launch technology that's currently emerging or will emerge soon, that number is going to change. Who knows what it is today or what it will be. But I think it's safe to say it's still going to be very, very expensive. And if you're on this corner-cutting Mars mission, they're not going to pony up for the Earth's soil. But there's a second point that's made by Dr. Sonnenberg in this article, and that point is that it might not matter. Because in a closed environment, separated from the rest of Earth, Sonnenberg says that the biodiversity of a soil sample will tend to decrease over time until you no longer have the balanced microbiotic jungle that you're looking for in this soil.
Hmm. So you end up with just this dead soil, yeah. Essentially.
The soil dies like you will. Yeah.
You know, this is interesting. It brings to mind two things. First of all, even though it would ultimately die, if we just needed to get soil into orbit, we could take the Great Escape route, right? Or I guess it was the Great Escape, and maybe it was Shawshank Redemption as well, where they you have the problem of, right, if you're digging a hole to escape from a prison, you have to do something with the dirt.
Yeah.
So you just you sneak it out a little bit at a time. Right. Uh-huh. So maybe we just start putting like a pocket full of dirt into on board each astronaut as they go up.
Every space launch?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great idea. Every time an astronaut goes to the ISS, they just take some fistfuls of soil.
Yeah. Of course, again, it doesn't really do much good if it's dead.
Right.
But the other thing that kept entering my mind is we consider the possibility of organisms bringing their soil with them when they travel to a new land in order to thrive and to live is, of course, Dracula. Because Dracula left his home in Transylvania to begin life in London, he brought with him a bunch of that soil from his native land, right?
Yeah, and you actually see this in ancient religious concepts too, like the idea that the god I worship is the god of my lands, mm-hmm. and if I want to worship my god in a foreign land, I might want to take some soil from where I came from with me, so I'm still technically on the lands of my god when I worship him.
Huh. Well, there you go. There's some that's probably some great food for thought when it comes to any ancient astronaut scenarios, right? Because clearly this idea was handed down to us by quote-unquote gods who traveled from another planet and had to bring their own soil because they were aware of the problems here, of venturing to a new world cut off from your Earth.
They were the reason the Colossus of Rhodes was anatomically correct. So ultimately, what will life be like separate from Earth dirt? We just don't know, and the prospects are intriguingly scary, and I think this is something that needs to be researched very well before somebody makes that leap and says, okay, I'm a Martian now. But there's another risk that you might run when you take the leap to say, I'm a Martian now, which is that you're not going to have a lot of room on Mars. And you might not necessarily have a lot to do on Mars, and you're not going to be able to leave if you want to.
Right.
And you might be confined in this small space with several other people who you don't get to get away from if you don't like them.
And that's where space madness enters the equation.
Right. We would be remiss if we did not talk about space madness. So what is the deal with psychological health on Mars?
Well, you know, we've already touched a little bit on how radiation could play into it. But just when we're dealing with the possibilities of dealing with a confined space, not much variety in your environment, certainly on the trip there, but even once you get there, you know, you're stuck in this little shell perhaps, and then occasionally you get to engage in this very stressful jaunt out into the dust-ravaged landscape. But you're opening yourself up to the psychological effects of isolation and seclusion, social isolation, as well as just, you know, a lack of variety in your environment. There have been, you know, countless studies that have looked at how isolation affects the human mind.
Yeah.
How when we don't, you know, it comes back to what we've evolved to live in. We've evolved to live in this rather vibrant world of fixed and movable objects, of interacting people and things.
Yeah.
And when you leave that, your brain kind of starts gnawing on it, creating the varied stimuli that you have come to, your brain has come to expect.
Yeah. So we're here on Earth, we're the mice on the mouse playground. On Mars, you might be the mouse in the tiny cage with nothing but a heroin button to push.
Right. And you better hope that the heroin button works. And of course, yeah, the whole time you're dealing with people, which can, of course, just in any given environment can be stressful. And then on top of that, you were traveling through space. You were going to a distant
right.
world. You're dealing with all the stress of that, which is only going to exacerbate any of these other conditions.
Yeah, you're possibly having lung conditions, serious lung conditions. You might be suffering from cancer. You might be suffering brain damage. You might be suffering weakness and bone density loss. You might be suffering from digestive distress, from lack of proper microbiome. And then you've got to deal with all these jerks in a 10-foot by 10-foot space.
Yeah, it's
surely not 10-foot by 10-foot. I just threw that out there. However big the space would be, let's hope it's bigger than that.
Yeah, it's an area that NASA's been looking into for a while, but it's also an area that we haven't had an extensive amount of research on because, for the most part, space flights are pretty busy. Even when you're dealing with these longer jaunts up to the ISS, because you have a lot of that time is taken up by, you know, just getting acclimatized to the orbital environment, forcing down your food, making yourself sleep, braving the indignities of orbital toilet use, and then, of course, yeah. conducting lots of experiments, repairs.
And all the exercise you have to do.
Yeah, hitting that Colbert treadmill up there. There's plenty to do. So we're not as yet dealing with the long-term solitude issues, the very long-term isolation issues.
And people don't spend, you know, 6 to 12 years on
right.
the ISS.
Yeah. But, of course, NASA's been looking into it, and they've studied how work, entertainment, and food can conquer the effects of solitude. The agency even invested $1.74 million in a virtual space station, a computer program designed to counsel astronauts about their emotional problems and insecurities. So we're essentially talking about the birth of robot psychologists here, which I believe the movie Moon explored.
We had the
Kevin Spacey voiced psychologist robot that regularly checks in with our main character to see how he's coping with this isolation.
I like that movie.
Yeah, it was fun. It had a number of cool sciencey topics, helium-3, isolation, and a few others I don't want to spoil. But there was also a 2008 study that was conducted at NHC Healthcare in Maryland Heights, Missouri, and they found that the robotic dog Aibo, is that his name?
It's Aibo, A-I-B-O.
That's the one, yeah. That particular robot, he, she, whatever, was just as effective at decreasing human loneliness as a living, breathing dog.
That's kind of weirdly depressing.
But comforting, because
we
probably don't want to send a dog on one of these journeys. God knows it's going to be difficult enough to send a human. But if you have a robot psychologist, a robot friend all wrapped up into one, maybe it's a robot dog psychologist, that can help mitigate the problems.
Yeah, I guess if you took a real dog to Mars, you'd have a big problem with, like, taking it out to do its business.
Yeah, I mean,
in the dust.
I've been watching a lot of shows recently that have robotic humanoids in it. The excellent Humans show that's been airing on AMC.
Yeah, you can tell me about that. I've got to check it out.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It makes me think, like, what you need to do is you need a robot family to send this space explorer with, right? You can't send him with him or her with their actual family.
You know, another way you could go is if you want to go down the Total Recall route, mm-hmm. the Quato route, and then you could have a friendly companion in your body with you, like Quato's you have Big Marshall Bell, and then he has Quato in his stomach.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, and maybe the form that could take is that essentially the AI on your ship or in your suit – like that is your buddy. Like your suit is your buddy. You talk to your suit, and your suit is analyzing your levels and your current state of physical fitness, and then also quizzing you about your mental health.
So it's like David Hasselhoff in his car.
Right.
What's the car called? Smart car.
Smart car?
Is that no, I don't think so.
Not Hal.
Kit.
Kit. Kit's the
With
yeah.
Two T's.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because you need somebody to talk to, so talk to the computer. Okay. Anyway, it's, you know, it's not a perfect, perfect answer. But it's one we've been looking at.
Tying back into our Echo Borgs podcast, I think we would need better chat bots before this would make any sense. Otherwise, you're just going to be up there infuriated that it won't stop bringing up fruit trees.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to the idea.
Reminding you of the fruits you can't get.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to the idea that there are certain things that we've evolved as part of our lives.
Yeah.
And we would be dealing with long-term extraction from that environment. And so what can we do to mitigate the effects of removal from that environment and or the recreation of that environment on another planet and during the voyage to that planet?
Yeah. So is your solution to try to simulate Earth on Mars or to try to recognize that your Mars habitat isn't Earth and deal with the problems as they arise?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, maybe you try and find some sort of space between.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of one of the elements from Philip K. Dick's The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldrick.
I want to read it just based on that title.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful book. It's one of his trippier books and really one of his best, in my opinion. But you have these individuals in space, and they take this drug called CAN-D, which allows them to share the experiences of these perky pat layouts that they play around, which is essentially kind of like Barbie play houses with little dolls.
Huh.
But it also reminds me a lot of the computer game The Sims.
Oh,
where
okay.
You really end up, I haven't played it in, you know, over a decade, but I remember when it came out and I'm playing it, I remember how invested I felt in these little, you know, non-existent characters and their little, very, you know, one-dimensional lives. But it reminded me even then a lot of Perky Pat. And of course in this scenario, there's a pharmaceutical, means of increasing your involvement with Perky Pat. So I don't know, maybe it's a situation of giving the astronaut a robotic family that looks after him and analyzes his mental state, and then also secretly, you know, pumping ecstasy in him the whole trip. Maybe that's the answer. That's what I'm suggesting.
We're going to have to be way less prudish about our methods to keep the astronauts truly happy.
Yeah, you kind of end up having to perhaps take that that lab rat mentality, right?
Well, yeah.
This is maybe less a person and more an experiment. This is more about the living cargo and how do we keep the cargo in shape for the duration.
Yeah, that is an interesting question. How mercenary do you want to be about keeping the astronauts on your Mars colony happy? Like, if you found that you could just give them a drug that would make them, you know, sort of placated in the Aldous Huxley sense, to go back to that, you know, if you could make a brave new world on Mars and that was a pretty reliable way to keep the astronauts from going crazy, would you do it?
Yeah. I mean, and it also just drives home that we don't belong there, in a very, very basic sense. Like, this is not our world, and it's completely inhospitable to the human form. We want to go there. We want to go there to so that we can say, hey, we have been to Mars, and then in our grander visions of the thing, we want to recreate Earth life there. But is that just kind of a ridiculous notion that we eventually have to get past?
Yeah, I don't know. Is it wishful thinking?
Yeah.
I don't want the takeaway from this episode to be, let's not go to Mars.
Right, right. I mean,
I don't feel that way. I'm, in a lot of ways, I support a very aggressive program of space exploration and colonization. But I think we're just highlighting how difficult this project is if we want to do it right. All of the things we have to learn and all the things we're not even aware that we don't know about the dangers of space and Mars and colonization of other bodies in the solar system.
Indeed. The destination is hostile. The trip is dangerous and lonely. And those are realities we have to face if we are actually going to send humans to Mars.
Yeah, but if you're one of those people out there who's working on these problems right now, I salute you, and I say more people should support your efforts.
Indeed, yeah, I'm still 100% behind putting a human on Mars.
Just one, though.
Just one. Yeah, I don't think we should go crazy. Just one.
Really, it should just be Val Kilmer.
Just Val Kilmer. Or who's going to be in the upcoming film about the I think it's Matt Damon. There's a film about The Martian.
Yeah, I heard about that. I haven't read that book, but
I hear good things.
Yeah, interesting.
So we'll have to we'll have to revisit this topic when that film comes out, I guess.
Okay.
So there you have it, your life as a Mars colonist. All important stuff to think about before you sign on the dotted line.
Right.
Hey, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you want to check out our vast archive of videos, you want to check out our blog posts, links out to our social media accounts, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership, and that's where you will find everything.
And if you want to let us know about an interesting solution you've read about or thought of to any of these concerns we brought up today, or a threat that your health might encounter on Mars that we didn't even think to include, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.